Welcome to the Wilson Disease edition of Rare Disease Advisors Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the WD community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're talking with Dr. Omar Kamlin, a UK-trained neonatologist who practices as a clinical researcher for 18 years in Melbourne, Australia. In 2020, he joined Orphelan, a French pharmaceutical company specializing in rare disease, as senior medical director. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
So let's talk about Wilson disease. It's very rare. Not a lot of people know much about it. Can you give us an overview of the disease and why you chose to specialize in this particular illness?
Wilson disease is a rare disease. The prevalence is approximately 1 in 30,000. So we estimate in a country such as the US that we would have 8,000 patients. But it's underserved, and it requires lifelong therapy. And the key unmet needs in the disease space is often under recognition, delayed diagnosis, and that can lead to irreversible liver and neurological impairment. Wilson disease is a disorder of copper metabolism. It's a genetic disease, and the root cause of the problems associated with Wilson disease is the inability of the individual to remove copper. We all eat copper. It's part of our, it's an essential element in our diet, Even though you might be born with Wilson disease, it takes time to present with the clinical signs and symptoms because there's gradual accumulation of copper primarily in the liver, but it's a multisystemic disease. It can affect the brain, the eyes, the bones, the joints, and the bone marrow.
And if not treated, it could lead to death, right?
Yeah, it's definitely life-threatening, yes, without treatment. And treatment was first introduced over 70 years ago. And prior to that, yes, it was universally fatal.
So I understand it's called Wilson disease because Dr. Wilson discovered it in 1902.
1912, he wrote a seminal paper.
Okay.
Absolutely right. Kinnear Wilson was a neurologist. Mm-hmm. And in those days, before we have all the advances in medical diagnostics, he wrote a case series of a family where several members were affected. As a neurologist, he was seeing them from a neurology perspective. They had abnormal movements, abnormal posturing, abnormal speech. But he also noticed when he examined their abdomens that they had a very hard, coarse, knobbly liver. And this is, of course, before the introduction of ultrasound or MRI or biopsy. So he called it hepatolenticular degeneration, so meaning the toxin he hypothesized originated in the liver and it was affecting the brain. So he was right on many counts, but he couldn't attribute it to copper at that time. So the implication of copper being involved came much later in the late 40s. And
I understand.
But he was absolutely spot on that the defect is actually in the liver.
And until your therapy came along, there was nothing to treat Wilson disease?
No. So the first approved treatment is D-penicillamine. And that was introduced in the early 50s. It was discovered by William Walsh in the UK. And whilst it's very effective, it's a chelator. So what it does is bind the excess copper in the blood.
It's a what?
A chelator. So a chelation therapy. So in terms of Wilson disease, there are essentially at the moment the approved therapies, there are two classes, the chelators, of which there are two, D-penicillamine and trientine. Now, trientine hydrochloride was actually developed in the 60s in response by the same team that identified and developed D-penicillamine because of the severe side effects of D-penicillamine.
And yours is trientine tetrahydrochloride?
Yes.
Okay.
So trientine by its nature is a highly volatile, unstable product. And so trientine hydrochloride is a capsule form and has to be refrigerated under cold storage. And that adds burden to both the patient and obviously in the production and the transportation manufacturing process adds extra cost. So we took, not we, me personally, because I joined the company 3 years ago, but when Orphalan was developing this product, we recognized that this was a need for both the physicians and the patient community, that cold storage was a real burden. Getting the drug to the pharmacy, patients having to take this medication for life, having to rely on refrigerated product, was a real burden. And that affected compliance and adherence to the prescribed therapy. So what we wanted to do was to address that. So to produce a tablet, which is more palatable than a capsule, and scored so you can split it in half for more precise dosing, we managed to achieve that. And first of all, gain approval in the European market. So the EMA approved our product at the end of 2017, and we've been on the market in Europe since 2018, and we have over 1,000 patients on product in Europe and the UK. We then during this phase wanted to introduce the product to the US market, and in doing so, we conducted a phase 3 study. A non-inferiority trial, which was published last year, 2022, in the Lancet Gastroenterology Hepatology. It's called the Chelate trial, and this is the first randomized trial comparing the established treatment of D-penicillamine. You may recall I said it was been available since 1956. With triantine, which has also been around for since the early 60s and approved in 1985 in the UK. So these compounds, these chelators, have been around a long time. But as you, I'm sure, know in other rare diseases, that therapies tend to creep in without a lot of evidence.
Yeah.
So there weren't, there's a real paucity of randomized control trials.
And this trial that you're referring to is with placebo?
No, it was a non-inferiority trial of triantine tetrahydrochloride versus D-penicillamine. Okay, so the standard of treatment. So these patients that we enrolled in the trial were on average diagnosed 20 years before and were taking D-penicillamine. D-penicillamine is approved in Europe and in the US as the first line indication. Now, US physicians have over the years abandoned use of D-penicillamine because of the side effect profile. And most physicians in the US prescribe triantine.
What kind of side effects does that have?
D-penicillamine?
Yes.
Well, we know up to a third of patients have to discontinue treatment. So it can cause disfiguring skin disorders, elastosis, renal impairment, nephrotic syndrome, bone marrow suppression. So it's got a black box label in the US. So physicians need to be aware of the side effect profile and knowingly, if they're prescribing D-penicillamine, screen these patients regularly for any side effects.
And you mentioned that Kuvriar is stable at room temperature, does not need to be refrigerated.
Indeed. So mm-hmm. Kuvriar comes in a blister pack. And so it's portability for added patient convenience. And yes, it is a twice. In the chelate trial, we compared it to D-penicillamine milligram for milligram dosage. Patients were taking their D-penicillamine and their triantine tetrahydrochloride twice daily. So it's twice daily. The other triantines are 2 to 4 times daily, but we have demonstrated in this non-inferiority trial that triantine tetrahydrochloride had comparable efficacy, potency, to D-penicillamine. And of course, given the more favorable safety profile of triantines in general over the last 60 years, we also found in the study that the safety profile was in keeping with what we know from triantine exposure and experience in the last 50 years.
And this medication must be taken on an empty stomach, removed from mealtimes, at least 1 hour before or after, correct?
Correct. Okay. So all Wilson disease therapies, whether it's chelators, that's D-penicillamine, or triantine, or the third product, which is zinc salts, and zinc acetate is the approved therapy, they all have a food effect. So triantine itself is poorly absorbed. It's highly soluble, poorly absorbed. And we have some very exciting new data coming out from Denmark, which suggests that we have a dual mode of action. So trientine tetrahydrochloride also binds copper in the gut before it's absorbed, and the product that's absorbed binds copper in the blood. So it's a systemic chelator, a bit like d-penicillamine and the other trientine. So one way of monitoring patients with Wilson disease is to measure their urinary copper excretion over a 24-hour period. And in our chelate trial, what we found is that the free copper, that's the non-seroplasmin-bound copper, the free or labile copper pool, that's a potentially toxic pool of copper. So your aim of therapy was to try and minimize that pool. So you and I, who don't have Wilson disease, our copper is regulated by excretion. Copper is usually excreted from the liver back into the intestine, and we pull out the excess copper that we don't need. In Wilson disease, the only way to remove the copper is either to block it in the intestine, in the gut, or to remove it in the urine, and that's what the chelators do.
So a question, why do people with Wilson disease have a problem getting rid of this excess copper, and what causes it?
So the defect is a protein on chromosome 13, it's the ATP7B protein, and so this is a copper transporter within the liver cells. So it's once the copper is absorbed from our diet, it's then shipped to clot in the blood, in the portal vein, to the liver. And then the liver takes up the copper, and within the liver, the copper is then packaged into the main copper-carrying protein in the blood, seroplasmin. And because there isn't sufficient movement of copper within the liver, the seroplasmin protein lacks copper. And so it doesn't last very much in the circulation. So over time, the copper builds up in the liver. Normally, the other role of the ATP7 protein is to transport copper from the liver cells to the biliary duct. And then it's excreted in the bile back into the intestine. And like I said, we remove it through defecation.
Understand. Okay, so we're almost out of time. I wanted to ask you about your relationship with patient advocacy organizations. How do you find the patients? And more importantly, I'm imagining this is a very expensive therapy. How do they afford it?
So we have a very proud working relationship with the Wilson Disease Association. They've recently celebrated their 40th anniversary this year, and they are fantastic advocates for the Wilson disease community in the US. Now, we have just launched in the US in April this year, and we have a navigator program which will make our treatment accessible, and our commercial team can certainly advise your readers, but also if you want to check it out, go to couvrior.com, and it gives you all the details of how you're able to get access to this treatment. We have co-pay programs, patient assist programs, and we are working with insurance companies and Medicare and Medicaid to make this available with minimal out-of-pocket expense.
Very briefly, what's on the horizon for Wilson disease in terms of potential therapies, or if there's something coming down that might be even better?
Look, so we're chatting at AASLD, the primary liver meeting for North American physicians. There are presentations from the gene therapy companies. So there's gene therapy that's being developed, actively recruiting patients into clinical trials. And I think we're going to get early readouts from one of the companies early next year.
Is that by any chance Ultragenyx?
Yeah.
Okay.
So. And the Vivet Therapeutics is the other.
Uh-huh.
In terms of what we're doing as a company, like I mentioned, we have a product which is twice daily. And we recognize that to remain healthy and to have a normal life expectancy to your next door neighbor, it really relies on the patient taking their medication day in, day out. And you've already highlighted how difficult that can be if you have to avoid it with meals.
Right.
So the one way that we can potentially address that, we can't change the compound, so there's always going to be that food effect, but actually to try and reduce the pill burden, okay, with the ultimate goal to making it less frequent. So the only way to make it less frequent from twice daily is once daily. So we're really investing in our R&D program to come up with and develop a once-daily product.
Dr. Kamlin, thank you very, very much for your time. I appreciate it. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.